Okay, so I am the last speaker of the day, and so if I get done, you get to have those nice things to eat. And the talk here is on planning, actually, and I believe one of the workshop titles themselves is planning and replanning, so it's again for something completely different for this talk after the topic models. And I should also mention that because I'm a planning guy, I planned my schedule, and I woke up at 4 o'clock this morning, and I caffeinated myself so that I could be staying awake until 4:30 evening, so that my talk will get over. I believe it's like 4:45, so anything that you see from me is completely unplanned activity. That's sort of the problem with the plans, in the sense that, you know, from now onwards, I'm actually uncaffeinated, I guess. So I would be talking today about some issues in automated planning, and since I seem to be more or less the representative of automated planning community here, I'll also give you a little bit of a background on what the community does before I go into what I'm doing and what I'm pushing for of late. And so that, you know, you'll hear enough times that what I'm interested in is model light planning, that we'll discuss it in a minute. Okay, so before I go forward, I guess I should mention that, I was here the whole of today, and I also heard something about what happened yesterday, and it looks like the talks here are falling into a variety of topics. And since I was sitting there when David Bly was giving a talk, I did probabilistic topic modeling and figured out that there are apparently at least three types of things that are going on here: bio-inspired folks, pro-human folks, and mechanophiles, you know, people who love machines, apparently. And so I should situate myself as to which of these camps I am in, presumably, before I go forward. So the bio-inspired, I love the flocks and I love the swarms and, you know, the pictures that were shown. But call me a naive idealist, but I would like to hope that commanders, mission commanders and soldiers aren't exactly flocking and swarming when they're bringing democracy to other countries. Okay? So I'm interested in higher level planning with deliberation, and so I can deal with critters, but, you know, I am not very much in the bio-inspired side, particularly because I don't think my work, which is about higher level planning, can be influenced too much by what ants and critters do. Okay, maybe I'm wrong, but that's where I am right now. And yes, sir. Where robots are?
Robots. I mean, we're losing thousands of robots in various forms.
So you're worried that they might swarm and take. Possibly. But I guess I also want to actually, you may well be right. And in fact, but I just think there is enough time while we can plan for the contingency. That's part of my talk. Regarding the pro-human aspect, I'm not particularly crazy about humans. It's just that I do have to deal with the humans in the loop for my planning. And so in between, you know, mechanophile and bio-inspired, etc., I find a Buddhist middle ground, which is essentially how do automated planners, what challenges do automated planners face when they have humans in the loop? And those are some of the issues that I would talk about in the context of in my research, okay? But before I get there, I do want to talk to you about what automated planning is, just because it seems to me, based on the discussion, since I was last most of the day, I assume some of you would be last rest of the day. And so I want to introduce this field to you a little bit, and then talk about what I do. What are the interesting directions right now? Okay, so planning, of course, is the most important thing any pink agent would try to do, which is given an environment and some goals that you're trying to achieve, what is the next action that, what's the best next action that you're supposed to do, okay? And, you know, computing that, given the model, is really the planning problem, okay? And, you know, this is AI 101. Obviously, the difficulty of planning depends a lot upon the kinds of actions that you have, the kind of environment you have, the kind of perception you have. And the simplest kind of planning occurs when you are in a static environment, a fully observable environment, you have deterministic actions, and you have perfect sensing. That's the simplest, right? Now, so that's, we call it classical planning, because calling it simplistic planning wouldn't give you too much credit. So we call it classical planning, and in that case, so in the sort of a simple toy domain, there is stacking blocks when you have steady hands so that they won't fall off the table. So you could talk about actions in terms of their preconditions and effects. You can talk about the world state in terms of state variables and their valuations. And there are ways of representing these kinds of actions in certain standards right now called, for example, PDL, planning description, planning domain description language. And then if you write these actions and you're given an initial state, all you're trying to do is start from the initial state, consider the actions that you get to do from that state, consider the actions that you can do from those and those until you get to a state which the goals are satisfied. Simple enough problem. Now, of course, this is, as I said, this is the simplest kind of planning. The question, of course, is how hard is it really? Clearly, you know, I could draw this on a slide. Is it really hard? Unfortunately, in fact, even in this simple case, computational complexity of planning is p-space complete. Okay, why p-space complete? You know, this is blocks world after all. If I can give you a particular way of stacking blocks, you should be able to check in polynomial time whether or not it's a correct correct way to get to the goal state. The reason it turns out is because you can write this little Tower of Hanoi problem as a planning problem. And then, as you know, Tower of Hanoi, with the initial state specification, the plan length of the plan is exponential in terms of the initial state specification. So this is an easy way, a cheating way of remembering why this little problem is actually p-space complete. It's hard. Okay. Now, this is the kind of problems that planning people started looking at, and this is, 10, 15 years back, people used to, again, remember, you are given this model, the action descriptions and so on for a particular domain, and you are supposed to try and come up with plans and, you know, search for plans. And 10, 15 years back, this is the kind of pictures that people will draw as to how, you know, somebody else was unable to solve problems even with one or two blocks. We are able to go all the way up to five blocks. Okay? Now, it's late in the evening, but I still hope that you will be able to tell who drew this, who put this particular picture in their paper, the guy who had this as their planner or the guy who had this as their planner. I'll leave it up to you to figure out how to get a paper, okay? So what's changed? What has changed of late in the last like a decade or so is a significant quantum improvement in the speed, in the scale-up of the planning problems. Now, have we somehow showed that P equal to NP, and does the P-space completeness not hold? Of course not. The hardest problems are still very hard. What we did make a big progress on is coming up with heuristics, domain-independent heuristics. Okay, so you just take the domain specification, relax the specification, for example, by relaxing, let's say, the negative interactions between actions, solve the abstract problem fast, and use that to guide the search. And that could make a huge amount of difference. In particular, in fact, you spend a lot of time computing the heuristic, but it turns out the time you spend in computing the heuristic more than is made up for in the overall search. So this is a big change that happened in planning. So we can now solve 100 actions or larger number of plans in under minutes and seconds. Okay, and every year there is like a competition in this community, every 2 years, international planning competition, and every year there's a new guy who is winning, and they are doing much larger plans. Okay, so that's all well and good. So the primary revolution in planning in the recent years has been methods to scale up plan synthesis, efficient methods to scale up plan synthesis, and they came to some extent from relaxation heuristics. That means you're not cheating by saying for blocks world you should throw all the blocks on the table and put them from bottom up. No, you're just given the same model, you're using relaxation, automatic relaxations of the model to improve the search. Okay, so that's a pretty very reasonable AI thing to do. Okay. So, in my own group, we have done our own fair bit. We had planners that won competitions, students who got, outstanding dissertation awards, and, we also got some influential paper awards. Okay, so that's that. So what next? Now, as I said, when you saw that pink agent, this was the simplest case, a static world, deterministic world, observable, instantaneous, propositional. That's the simplest case. And that was itself P-space complete, and we were able to scale it up using good heuristics. The question then is, what do you do next? Now, obviously, you will wake up and realize that since these are all assumptions, let's start relaxing the assumptions. Okay, so if you don't have instantaneous actions, you'll get temporal reasoning, you'll have durative actions, that will be temporal planning, you can have numeric constraints, metric planning, you can have dynamic worlds where there are other agents, or the agent, the world is changing while you're doing execution, so you need to start doing replanning. You can have partial observability, you can have stochastic actions, and you can combine these. So after you remove one assumption at a time, you can start removing two assumptions at a time, three assumptions at a time, and great computer science thing is if there are n assumptions, there are 2^n ways of relaxing them. So we can keep ourselves busy, like very nicely, okay? Now, what that means is the trajectory in this community has been going this way. So you started with the classical planning, and now that you are able to improve the scale up there, you are considering more expressive problems, the ones with durative actions, the ones with numeric variables, non-determinism, partial observability, and stochastic actions, and so on. Now, the good thing about this in this direction has been that the classical planning problem by itself is not particularly interesting. Where do you get a world where everything is the easiest case? It's true that it's a bad, hard problem for you, but you probably are not going to get the assumptions met anywhere. However, the speed up that you did, the scale up that you're able to get in classical planning has actually helped in solving these other problems quite significantly. So, for example, just talking about my own group, we were able to use the heuristics in the classical planning to come up with very effective temporal planners in 2003, one for partial observable and non-deterministic planning in 2006, and most recently, in fact, for stochastic planning, you can again use deterministic approximation. So the idea is, I believe somebody was mentioning to me that yesterday Matthew Carlyle talked about this. You could essentially have, in that case, he was talking about anticipatory scheduling where there is exogenous uncertainty, the goals are uncertain. If you have stochastic actions, it's an endogenous uncertainty. That means the actions themselves have uncertain effects, and you can sample the evolution of the world. You'll get a deterministic model, and then you use classical planners to solve that and use that to decide what's the best action to do. In fact, the guy who's sitting here, Sung Ho Kyun, actually was the primary author on that work. And F.F. Hopp, interestingly enough, before all this revolution in classical planning happened, there was a large amount of work in stochastic planning directly, obviously using Markowitz processes and PAM-DP models and so on. And it's interesting to know that, in fact, efficiency-wise, F.F. Hopp beats all the MDP-based methods quite significantly. Okay, so this is sort of like, you could ask, why would people waste their time solving SAT problems? Well, you know, there are many other problems that can be compiled down to SAT problems, so solving SAT problems of large instances could be quite useful. Similarly, our own substrate in, you know, automated planning turned out to be a classical planning problem, so that if you made big strides in actually improving the scalability, you could use that in solving these other problems. Okay, and again, these three are from my group, and they all actually exploit the advances in the classical planning. While that in itself is not an interesting problem, these other ones are interesting problems. Okay, so this is the trend. That this is one way in which you can keep going forward. And there are assumptions. You know, anytime. So from here onwards, essentially what I want to talk about really is give you problems, not necessarily solutions. I'll give you my solutions, but I also want to sell you problems. Okay? I've been told that all research is a solution looking for a problem, and it's evening, so I want to do the opposite. I'll give you problems, and I'll give you some of my solutions, but hopefully you'll also work on it. Okay? So traditional planning, so this particular direction is making an assumption of complete models. You are assuming that you have been given complete action descriptions, you've been given fully specified user preferences, you've been given all the information about the objects in the world, and also it makes the assumption that in all those cases, you just have to make one plan and you're done with it. One-shot planning. Okay? So this actually allows planning to be a pure inference problem. So you can keep the machine learning folks that side of the room, planning folks this side of the room. They don't have to talk to each other, and we can have different sessions, you know, for each of us. Okay? But unfortunately, the problem, I mean, there are, you know, there are many, many reasons why these assumptions can be violated, but the one that I'm interested in talking about to you is the nefarious influence of humans in the loop. Okay? And if you put humans in the loop, all these assumptions fail for different reasons. Okay, first, complete action descriptions. Do people actually write domain models correctly such that every action is exactly specified? By the way, I just noticed that in the morning there was a question as to if you are given the full situation awareness, would the problem be easy? Up until now, you heard the solution for that. It's still not easy. If you're given the full model, the problem is not easy. Now I'm going to make it worse by saying you don't actually get full model. You don't get complete action description because you have fallible domain writers. Okay? You don't get, and in fact, this is the kind of thing I think Tom Dietrich was asking this morning. So you're expecting probabilities. Where are you getting them? Okay? If you give me some, then I can infer with it, but exactly where are you getting them? Preferences, you know, all the planners assume that the objectives are given so that they can optimize with respect to those objectives, okay? But I don't know if you ever dealt with humans, they don't give you objectives, and they'll yell at you. You know, you'll give a plan, and they say, no, that's not what I had in mind, okay? Give me a better one. And so the question, of course, is how do you deal with, so this is uncertain users. So we have uncertain actions, uncertain goals, and we have uncertain users, people who don't know what they really want, okay? Which is, by the way, all of us. Okay, and then you have open world. You don't know all the objects in the world, and you, for example, we are involved in a MURI project where a goal, a reasonable goal, you know, this is an urban search and rescue scenario, and a reasonable goal, which we wind up talking about, is report on all the injured humans that you find. Okay, it's a tricky issue. You don't know how many humans are injured, and you can injure them, and and then get a lot of reward, okay? But the question is, how exactly are you going to make these goals be satisfied, you know, if given that you have, you know, open worlds, okay? And then finally, one-shot planning is out because most of the time you are revising plans continually. So what happens in this case is that basically all these assumptions are violated, and so planning is no longer a pure inference problem. Okay? And so it really is like AI in general. There is no pure learning problem. There's no pure planning problem. Machine learning people in certain parts would like to think we don't need to do anything with this knowledge. We just have to learn this knowledge and give it to some random human to figure this out. And the planning people think somebody else will give them the model and then they just have to, you know, reason with it. But really, obviously, they're connected. Okay? So it's no longer a pure inference problem, and I've been actually, for the last 3 years or so, I've been looking at a different axis. I mean, I still like this axis. I do, you know, I have students writing papers on them. In fact, there's one of them here, and, you know, I don't want him to think that his thesis somehow is reduced in importance. But I believe that you need to start looking at a different axis too, which is what exactly do you do with the model incompleteness? You know, how do you deal with preference incompleteness, dynamics incompleteness, and the world incompleteness? Okay. Now, you might want to jump right away and say, oh, well, obviously, it's just learning. But actually, what I'll try to convince you is that you can't just say, when I'm giving you an incomplete model, you can't just say, I'll wait until you give me a better model. Okay, and you go learn a better model, and I'll wait until then. That's not the way the world works. Okay, you cannot tell a user that I will wait until you make up your mind before I'll start giving you plans. Then you're not going to have any customers. Okay, so you have to talk about what does it mean to infer using incomplete models. Okay, so here are some challenges. So as I said, basically I've been looking at this axis, and I call this model-like planning axis. The challenges that this brings up in particular are, so how do you circumscribe incompleteness? So as I said, there is incompleteness in preferences, dynamics, and world. And the first question, of course, is how do you circumscribe the incompleteness? You might say, what does that mean? I mean, you know, you said there's incompleteness. How can you have some knowledge about how incomplete your model is? And thankfully, I have ex-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, right, talking about the, you know, he's also a better philosopher than most of us. And he pointed out that there are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. Okay? And so he was a model-like planner at heart. Unfortunately, you know, I started doing this work after he got out of office, so otherwise I would have been much richer. But anyway, so the bigger point is, whether you like him or not, this is actually a good point. Okay? We sometimes know that there are certain aspects of the model we are not completely sure, they're not complete. And there are other aspects I can provide you certificates saying this much I know. Okay, otherwise we won't be able to live because we are all stuck with incomplete model. And when things go wrong, we say, this part of my car, I don't know anything about how car works. But I think that certain aspects of a model about how car works, such as color of the car doesn't decide whether or not it'll start in a cold day morning. That I know. So then, you know, when my car doesn't start, you don't see me repainting the car. But you will see me, you know, kicking the heck out of the tire, because that always helps, right? Okay. So the point is, we deal with incomplete models, and in that particular case, I knew that the color doesn't have any effect on the car running. Okay. So circumscribing the incompleteness, developing appropriate solution concepts. So if you have an incomplete model, what does it mean to solve the problem? It turns out, I'll show you that actually, In fact, the solution concept itself would be different when you have incomplete models. And then finally, developing planners capable of synthesizing these solution concepts. And then last, of course, is you don't want to live with incompleteness for all your life. You want to learn. You want to learn a better model. Okay? So you notice that the machine learning people in this room, which may be, you know, a whole bunch of them, they probably have right away thought about this. But my point is, you can't just wait for a better model to just fall from the heavens. You know, you need to live with the incomplete model you have while you try to improve the model. Okay, so these are some interesting challenges about in this direction that I mentioned to you. And these are all tough problems. I don't actually have clean answers to all of them. My hope actually is some of you will have better answers than me. And then I was told at least when I was, given this invitation to this workshop, that this is not to sell my work, but to start new directions, which hopefully, other people also will get, interesting ideas. So I'm trying to sell you some problems. Okay, these are tough problems. And I want to now, for the rest of the time, I'll talk to you about some of the initial solutions I have for these directions. They may or may not be great. They're all published. That's okay, but they may not be great and they may not stand the test of time. But I believe the problems are important. Okay, that may also be, controversial, but I think they're important problems. Okay, so my, the contributions themselves for the preference incompleteness, handling preference incompleteness, we looked at how to handle unknown preferences. That means you have no idea what the user wants. Okay, and partially known preferences. That means you know some features that seem to matter for the user. And for model incompleteness, we looked at what happens if you have information about possible preconditions and effects, apart from the known preconditions and effects for an action. And then we can use that to talk about robust plans and generate robust plans. And in these particular cases, actually for the preference incompleteness case, the solution concept winds up being diverse plans. Okay, that means if you think that your user doesn't know what exactly they want, you show them a couple of plans, not one. There are some people who are old enough here to have actually used travel agents. The human ones. Just as computer used to be human in 1900s, travel agent used to be not Expedia, back 10 years back. Okay? And then if you called a travel agent and you said, I want to go to this following city, and they just say, here is your flight. What would you do? You say, how dare you tell me what my flight is? You're supposed to give me some choices. And I'm supposed to act like I know what I'm talking about and pick one of those choices. Otherwise, I would go to a different travel agent. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it is indeed the case that when you have users' preferences are not known, you have to deal with, you have to generate diverse plans that potentially span different kinds of preferences that they might have. Okay? And that's why these two wind up being two different aspects here. And then finally, for the world and object incompleteness, one of the interesting things we'll point out is, once again, so here we'll talk about an idea called open world quantified goals, which is essentially getting the robot, I remember I mentioned this particular world object incompleteness problem in the context of urban search and rescue scenario where a robot is asked to just find and report on injured people. Okay. The question, of course, is an automated robot doesn't have to know where injured people are supposed to be. And a planner would not necessarily be able to plan such a way that the robot would go into the places where injured people are likely to be. So you almost have to give some information to the planner about where they might be found, and they will wind up becoming conditional goals. And we'll talk about how those can be specified and used in the context of planning. Okay, so that's the...
Well,
yes, sir.
You make a difference between reference and goal, right?
Not really. You can think of them... I kind of right now, but in general preferences... So I think they're not supposed to be different. Although in some of my examples, they will actually say the feasible plan will get to the goal, but, there are different versions of which I might have more preference for.
So preferences are not top goals?
They don't have to be. They don't have to be. Okay.
Is that a good thing, unknown preference? I mean,
so I'll show you an example. So let's just, we'll make it cleaner a little bit in a minute. Okay. So preferences in planning, so again, I'm going to just, in this contribution, and I'll go through this and this, either that or I fall apart because I'm too sleepy, and then either way you start eating, okay? So preferences in planning, the traditional view has been that you will provide the exact optimality metric that, that you're interested in, and the planner tries to kill itself to figure out and prove that the solution it found is optimal. Either that or no preferences is specified, then you assume they have no preferences. Do you understand what I'm saying? I know it's like, I don't know whether you have ever dealt with people, but just because somebody doesn't provide a preference doesn't mean they have none. Okay, and so we assume that they didn't provide a preference, so that none is, you know, everything is just, you know, equally good. That means any plan which has some minimal characteristics, such as it's a path from the current state to a goal state, is equally good. That would be the assumption, you know, traditional planners have made. Okay, but when you are human, when you, for example, have humans in the loop, then you essentially have to consider these partial preferences. And as I said, let me give you another, you know, kind of a compelling reason as to why this sort of a thing happens. You know, search engines, all of you have used it. None of you know how to probably stack blocks, okay, but all of you have used search engines. If you have provided a search query, a query, right, how do you think the search engines work? They don't quite know, other than the fact that hopefully the files that they're giving you should have those words, they don't quite know which of those files are more interesting to you than others. Upfront, okay. So you know, the world's most important query turns out to be Kampham Party, according to me. And I ran that query on Google, okay. And you know, thankfully, I do come first. And there is some more stuff about me. But then, why this guy, this Ravindranath guy, and there's some other Kampham Party, there's some other Kampham Party. So from my point of view, I might say, if I give the query Kampham Party, why did they even bother giving answers from other Kampham parties, for example? One way of understanding this, essentially, is that the search engine doesn't quite know who is actually asking the query. If I am logged in and it has, Google has figured out how narcissistic I can be, it should just give the top 10 results to be just my page. Right? Right? And if you are logged in and you are not particularly sure of how you look, maybe it should give you this, which is a plastic surgery guy. Okay? Now, otherwise, it should basically think that these are random people and you should give a whole diverse set of Kampham parties, which is basically what a search engine winds up doing. Notice that in the beginning, you will give a diverse set, but as you learn more about the user's preferences, you reduce the number of solutions you would give. Okay? The same thing you would do for planning. So you're going to diversify the results, return the answers that are closest to the query, and if you don't know anything at all, then you want to return the answers that are closest to the query and farthest from each other. As you know more about the preference matrix, the distance matrix can change. Now the distances would be defined in terms of the features that actually are relevant. Okay? In the work that we did, as I said, we looked at a unknown preference case, and then there is also a partially known preferences case. In the case of unknown preferences, what we wind up doing is defining distance metrics that make sense for plans. Okay. Now you do this, you know, for example, when you're talking about search engines, you have to talk about distance metrics between documents. And so you have to talk about distance metrics for plans. And we talk about reasonable sets of distance metrics for plans, and then use those to actually change the solution concept here to not just come up with a plan, but come up with, let's say, in particular, we'll be looking at something called D distance K set, which is K plans which are at least D distance away from each other. Okay, and then you can solve that problem. And you know, this one is just saying that you could actually use existing planners to find diverse sets of plans in a reasonably efficient way. Obviously, finding diverse plans is a harder problem than finding one plan. Okay, but you have to deal with it. That's the price you pay for not knowing the preferences. Okay, if you are talking about the partially known preferences, what changes here is you can essentially, you know which aspects of the plan actually are relevant to the user. Okay, so for example, in a travel plan, let's say you are in a travel domain, and basically a typical thing that matters is the time and the cost of the plan. In fact, for most plans, the total amount of time that is taken from the beginning to the end, which is the make span of the plan, and the cumulative cost of actions in the plan. Right? If you have those two are the only features, for example, and then upfront you may actually have assumed that it's some, let's say, linear function of these preferences. The question then would be, you just don't know what's the weighting factor between the features. Okay? And And it turns out that, so, and you might know upfront, W is not known, but you might know some distribution over W. If you don't know anything, you know, of course, you could assume, if you think all this, all values of W are equal, that basically means you assume uniform distribution. Otherwise, you have a more peaked distribution. Okay? And so, given the distribution of the W, which is not hard to get, because if you don't know anything, you just assume uniform. Okay? Then you can, you will essentially try to find plants that are a diverse set of plants that are good candidates for this objective metric. Now, you could actually use this, you know, look at this directly as a multi-objective optimization problem. Okay, because after all, there are just two features, and you can just find it, think of this as a multi-objective optimization problem, and you can compute the Pareto set and provide that to the user. There are two issues with it. One, of course, is a computational issue. Computing the full Pareto set can be quite costly. The other is the human in the loop issue. If you actually provide, you know, 100 plants on the Pareto set and say pick one, then basically that's as good as not giving anything to the human. Okay? So you want to find a good representation of the Pareto set you want to return k representative plants from the Pareto set, and you want to, the challenges here become how do you represent, how do you define the representative robustly, and how do you generate the representative set plants efficiently. Those are the two issues. Okay. I'm not sure that I'm going to go into the details here, but you know, the following can at least be understood by you. If I had no knowledge about the way the W, which is combining the cost and time, then if you have a Pareto set like this, then if I'm asking you for three representative plants, these would have been a reasonable set of three representative plants. If you had a more peaked representation for the peak distribution for W, then the right set of plants to provide would be these three. So the idea is here you know that the user more or less is in this region with a higher probability. Okay, so you are going to have to find the three set of three plants from the Pareto set such that they have the sort of the highest expected utility given the distribution that you have provided. Okay, and so that's what this ICP measure is actually computing. This is an actually interesting connection. I believe that there was some work by Matthew Carlyle who talked yesterday, who actually came up with, you know, some of the same issues for multi-objective scheduling. Okay. We use the ICP measure, which will allow us to actually talk about what the problem statement is. So provide me k plants which have the highest ICP measure, and then you can again use the existing deterministic planning technology to come up with finding those actual sets of plants. Okay. Now the other aspect of this is if you started with a distribution over W and that was just uniform, then based on the experience, you should be able to improve the, you know, W. So that's where the learning comes. So I basically want to say that before learning, you have to live with your incomplete model. And then you have to probably, you know, use those plans to figure out what the better model is. So in this case, I think it's not too hard for this crowd to see that you could essentially over iterations, you can actually get a better distribution over W, which can then be used for the later iterations for giving the diverse plants. So again, the example I try to give, and it probably might make sense given as late as it is today, is that if when you picked a phone and called your travel agent and they just gave you a single plan, a random travel agent, they gave you a single plan, you say, how dare you? Okay, but if after talking to you after interacting with you for years and years, every time they give you 10 plans for your travel agent, for your travel, that means they haven't learned a thing about you. Okay, and what they should be learning is your preference. In this particular aspect, it's basically the distribution of W for you. Okay, one other thing that we also did is sometimes you can also learn the user preferences more passively by following the executed plans, the plans that the users have executed, and learning from them what kinds of plans they seem to be preferring. Okay, there is a whole area in automated planning called hierarchical task network planning, which in essence tries to say that not all plans are created equal. Certain plans are more preferred by users, and those happen to have a certain grammatical structure. Okay, so for example, you know, when you're going from a place to place, while every possible way of transporting yourself, I can go for 1 mile by bus, then another mile by car, another mile by hitchhiking, another mile by, you know, bicycle, etc., and then come here, I more or less never use those kinds of plans for travel plans. I typically pick either, you know, flight plan or the train plan or the bus plan or something. Okay. So not all feasible plans are actually allowed because they are not satisfying this grammar. So the preferred, the user preferences can be learned in this case as a grammar over legal plans. In the previous case, we learned user preferences as a sort of a weight factor over, you know, features. Here we are learning it as a grammar over legal plans. Okay, and once again, here is a nice learning problem, and you can actually use basically EM style technique to learn these kinds of hierarchical preference models. Okay, so there is work in this on Ichikai 2009. What's interesting, actually, in a different crowd, I would have tried to explain to you what EM is, but I don't think I should even waste my time on that. But what's more interesting here is the input right? If I see people executing certain plans, can I assume that that's because they like them? Okay, many poor grad students, you see them executing the hitchhike plan. Okay, is that because they don't like first class air travel? or is it because their advisor funding agency is not giving them enough money to support first class air travel? Okay, so the point is that just because you see somebody doing something, that doesn't necessarily mean that they like doing that. They actually came up with a better plan and they tried to execute it. The resource restrictions caused that not to be executable. So they wound up preferring something else. So if you see what people do, you have to refilter the input to actually figure out what their true preferences are. This is in general a hard problem. You can't actually completely undo the filtering caused by the feasibility constraints. But you can do a reasonable there are some reasonable approaches which sometimes will be able to undo the filtering. Okay, so that's something that on the same grammar of references, we have an extension like ICAPS 2009, which tries to see how to change the input, which then, of course, once you change the input, then you can give it to your grammar learner. Okay, and once you have these preferences, then you can give it to your preference institution. Okay, so that's about preferences. So that's about preference incompleteness. I want to now talk a little bit about model incompleteness, at least the way we have done. Again, remember what I said earlier, these problems are more important. There are certain approaches I am taking, but you know, there may be better approaches, but you know, these problems are important. In terms of model incompleteness, so once again, actually, this too is about the fact that there may be actions. You have action descriptions which have possible preconditions and effects that you think might be there, but you know, obviously you're not sure. Okay. So planning with partial domain models, the motivation is that the traditional planners assume complete model. Again, that's so that the planning becomes a pure inference problem. Okay. We know exactly the conditions and effects of action execution. Now you might just say, well, stochastic actions, an action which has a stochastic outcome, might essentially allow us to talk about our ignorance. It's a tricky point. In fact, when you provide a stochastic action, you do have to provide full model there too. You have to provide the probabilities of various outcomes occurring. Okay, what's more interesting, actually, it turns out that when a stochastic action, the semantics of a stochastic action are that if you keep doing it, it will keep having different effects. Whereas if what we are trying to capture is that the domain, there is a true domain model, and the user, the domain writer was actually fallible and wrote, you know, approximations to the true domain model, then you don't expect doing the same action multiple times to have different action outcomes. Okay, so it turns out actually that the right way to think about it is not, the right way to think about it, I'll show you, is connected to partial observability. Basically, there are aspects of the action description that are not provided to you in the required affects and preconditions. So the simple the simple representation we are using for that case is, in addition to an action with the solid lines, which are required preconditions and required affects, we also have annotations on possible preconditions this action might require and possible effects this action might have. Now, the point of this is, again, remember Donald Rumsfeld's point, that sometimes you know that these might be effects, but you're not sure. Okay? So for those cases, you're actually able to write the possible effect annotations, and similarly, you're able to write the possible precondition annotations. And these are sort of circumscribing your incompleteness. Okay? And this already makes the action a harder action to deal with. It's not a simple action now, because these effects might or might not happen, these preconditions might or might not happen. And depending on how interested you are in providing a good expressive model, there may actually be correlations between when these effects, whether they're all independently realized, or they is there a correlation between the way they are realized. Okay, the current work we do, we assume that these are all essentially independently realized. So the true domain model might have, you know, all required preconditions and effects, and some subset of possible preconditions and possible effects. Okay, yes, sir. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's basically what I showed earlier. Let me, yeah, it's basically it's state variables. I'm just trying to show you, and I can't see this yet. No, this one. Yes. Okay. So that's your domain. Here is a simple action, a very simple action, which is providing the parameters of the action, what the preconditions are, and what the effects are.
So, I mean, basically, we instantiate a set of rules about what we believe is true in the environment.
Yeah, so the rules here are the action rules. Basically, the action requires certain things to be true, and then we'll make certain variables to have certain values. What? So are the actions going to give you a unique state, is what you're talking about?
Right.
Yeah, that's the difference between deterministic versus stochastic actions. Okay, as I mentioned in the very beginning, you know, you can start with these, which are the, you know, deterministic actions, and actually use the technology for classical planning to also efficiently solve stochastic, you know, planning. Okay.
I'm just trying to understand.
I understand that. That's fine. Okay, that's fine. Okay, so, yeah, and actually, you know, following up on Tom's point, one other interesting issue is planning has, I mean, so in AI, we talk about representations at atomic level, where states are black boxes and actions just take you from states to states, and propositional, relational, and first order. Okay, and as you go up in this representational hierarchy, you sort of essentially are providing a lifted representation for the actions, and the structure, so now the state will have a structure, it's no longer a black box, it has state variables, and it's the structure that is exploited in most of these planning heuristics. If in fact, you know, in the simplest case, in classical planning, is just a graph search over, you know, where states are vertices, in such a case, there is nothing you can do. Okay?
So,
exactly.
And an open world is one in which you cannot, you're short of some rules
so open world is you might actually have actions which have more effects than you wrote, and once you go to the relational level, it has objects that are not present in your model. Okay? Exactly. Okay, so again, and by the way, I mean, that's also a good point that when I went to the model light direction, I could have done model light for deterministic, temporal, stochastic, anything, but I just stuck to the deterministic planning, you know, in the beginning. Okay, so anyway, as I was saying, you know, for the deterministic actions, these are the deterministic preconditions and effects, and these are the possible preconditions and effects. And the solution concept for this kind of representation turns out to be a robust plan, which is essentially a plan is considered robust if it is going to work correctly in most domains, or the most likely domains. So either the probability mass of the domains in which it works, possible domain models it works, or if all of them are equally likely, just count the number of domain models in which the plan will work. So it's not enough to just make a plan that works with respect to the nominal model. You also want to see how many other possible models is it going to work. And the more it works in, the more robust it is. Okay? That's a very reasonable definition of robustness. Basically, when we say make the plan more robust, what do you mean? That means when the assumptions you made in modeling the domain don't actually work out, you hope that the plan will still work. That essentially means that it should work in more domain models than the nominal domain model. And for this particular case, the nominal model is just the one with the solid lines. And all the other ones are independent realizations of possible effects and preconditions. Okay. So, you know, in this particular case, so if you have a plan, then you can consider the total number of domains are the cumulative probability of the domain models over which the plan actually winds up working, and that would be its robustness. So actually computing the plan robustness itself becomes a hard problem now, you know, especially computationally hard problem, because previously given a plan, you can check whether it's correct or not by just simulating it, okay? Finding its robustness now sort of becomes a weighted model counting problem. And then you can use, you know, weighted SAT solvers to actually compute that if you want the exact value of the robustness of the plan. But what we are actually more interested in is generating the robust plans, okay, generating plans which are more robust rather than, you know, just generating the optimally robust plan. And for that, what we have looked at are two approaches, one where we compile this problem into a deterministic planning problem. I mean, into a known planning problem. And in fact, the way we compile it is essentially for each of these possible effects, there essentially you assume there is an unobservable variable, okay, whose value you don't know. And it's part of the initial state now. And because these are unobservable variables, there is a type of plan called a conformant plan, which is essentially getting to the goal state even though you don't completely know your initial state. And most of you know how to do this. I think a classic problem that, you know, some of you might know, but, you know, others may not have heard of, is this great problem called bomb in the toilet problem, where you go into a toilet and there are two identical looking packages, one of which contains a bomb. Okay? You can never figure out which one contains the bomb. The only thing you know is to dunk the package into toilet, and then it will diffuse the bomb. And imagine there is a good enough toilet that you can dunk any number of packages. Okay, so the question is, can you be safe? Because you know that you'll never be able to tell whether or not there is a bomb, and obviously all of you know that it can be solved. You just dunk both the packages into the toilet, and, you know, that's called conformant plan. And in robotics, there's this idea called compliant motion, right? Without knowing exactly where the hole is, this is why you put this bevel, so that when you touch any place in this bevel, the screw directly goes into the hole. So again, reducing the sense, without sensing, being able to do the planning, that's exactly the kind of planning you need for solving this problem. Okay? Except in a normal conformant planning problem, you want to say that irrespective of what the initial state is, you still should be able to guarantee that you will reach the goal state. Right now, what I want to say is I want to talk about probabilistic conformant planning. Give me a plan that with very high probability reaches the goal state. What? Okay. We convert this problem into the probabilistic confinement planning problem, and I actually mentioned earlier on there is a planner called Pond that I mentioned in the beginning of my work, which actually solves these kinds of problems. There is other planners too, and we can actually give this robust plan generation problem to these confinement planners. Okay. The other approach is a more direct approach where you bias a planner search directly towards more robust plans by changing the way the heuristics are computed for plans such that you prefer a plan which is going to work in more domains, you know, in terms of, you know, picking the actions that you're going to put into the plan. Okay. So that's sort of initial work on generation of the robust plans. Okay, so I done with preference. I told you about preference incompleteness and model incompleteness. I want to tell you a little about the work on world and object incompleteness. And as I said, that sort of in the context of this MURI project, which doesn't want to show up. Let's see. There's a video going on that you will not see, but it turns out that you have, let me just stop this so that at least you see that. Okay, so basically we have a scenario where a robot essentially is in a mixed human-robot scenario where some commander is outside telling the robot to go around this urban search and rescue scenario looking for injured people. Okay, and the kind of things, so we might, it's a human robot team, robot starts at the beginning of the hallway, human is giving higher level knowledge about what the goals are. There are, in this scenario, there's a hard goal saying reach the end of the hallway, but there's also a soft goal saying report the locations of the wounded people. Okay, now if you consider this, here is a situation where you don't quite know how many wounded people are there. So it's a incompleteness in the context of the number of objects. Now, how do you deal with problems like this? The good news is that some aspects of this particular problem can be handled by the existing planning technology, including partial satisfaction. If you don't have to report on every possible injured person. If you can report on the more, the merrier. I'm sorry, not merrier. I mean, you know, the more you report, you know, the better reward you get. And you also, the human in the loop might change the goals. They might say, it's getting too late. In fact, this is part of this MURI scenario where there's a full natural language interface between the human and the robot, and the human can once in a while screech saying, stop doing what you're doing, go to the end of the hallway. And you are supposed to recognize the affect in the voice and realize that they're really serious about this now and then run towards the end of the hallway. Okay, so that sort of a thing can be supported by replanning and execution monitoring. The bad news, of course, is the open world aspect. You have unknown model, unknown objects. You don't know where the injured people are, and the goals are now specified in terms of them. Okay, you're getting reward based on injured people who are, basically your reward is conditional on objects which you don't know whether they exist or not. Okay, now here's an interesting issue, again, that sort of puts planning and robotics in two extremes. In a planning scenario, as I said, the classical planners at least assumed full model has been given upfront, so it's a closed world kind of a scenario. So they would do under-sensing. They assume that if you didn't tell me somebody is injured in room 75, I assume there are no injured people, so I don't have to sense anybody. I just go to the end of the hallway. Okay. The other is a robot, which is sort of, you know, if you don't say anything, a robot basically can oversense. You know, it just basically look for humans, injured humans everywhere. You know, under tables, on top of the ceilings, stuck on the walls. I mean, you might think you know where injured people are. That's because you have domain knowledge. What does a robot know as to where the injured people are? You need to provide some partial domain knowledge as to where you might likely find injured people. Okay, and so what you want to provide is, so this would be over-sensing, so what you want to provide is some sort of a limited sensing where the planner provides guidance to the robot as to which parts of the map to look into. Okay, and now to give that, We use in our work, we use this idea called open world quantified goals, which is sort of giving additional information as to where you might find the injured humans, and if you were to find them, this is your goal. Okay, and once you have this sort of, you know, sort of a conditional goal, and so in some sense, the interesting question about these conditional goals is the right way to deal with them is you need some sort of a distribution as to where injured people are more likely to be, and then use that to figure out which places are worth sensing. Okay. In the work that we have done right now, we actually have used some sampling approaches, but we also used actually even the idea that even the idea that, you know, if you do actually assume that you want the robot, if the planner wants the robot to go into certain rooms, then in essence, it makes the robot, it essentially biases the model such that there are actually these virtual humans that might be found there. And when the robot actually goes there, you essentially, at that point, you will know whether or not there is a human there, really, and if so, you will have to report on that, okay? So in some sense, the planning in this case is the plans are generated over this, you know, there's a reward shaping going on. You essentially, plans are generated over this virtual space, which then during the execution, you will know whether or not, in fact, the reward is actually achieved, okay? So there's much more interesting detail, you know, on how to actually view these as conditional goals and, you know, how to actually handle this in a probabilistically sound way that I would suggest, I mean, that I obviously unfortunately can't go into right now, but there is a paper in ACM Transactions on Intelligent Systems that can be looked at to get some idea. Okay. This is the ending, yes, yes, sir. So, as I said, you know, there are one other thing in this particular case is replanning, which I'll not go into. So, I'll go into the last two slides. So, I mentioned that there are two challenges, there's a bunch of challenges for handling. I mean, I motivated a direction where you take into account the incompleteness, both of the domain models and the preferences and the world objects. And then I said, these are the challenges that you would have to look into if you start taking them seriously. And then the partial solutions I provided for each of these are summarized here for circumscribing the incompleteness in the preference component. For the preferences, I want to provide at least the components over which the preferences might depend on. And if not, then I will have to look at fully diverse plans just based on the distances between plans. And for the action incompleteness, I can consider the possible precondition effect annotations. And then for the object incompleteness, then I was using the open world quantified goals. For the developing of the appropriate solution concepts, I considered diverse plans for one, robust plans, and then this last one was partial sensing plans, which all of which are different from the normal, you know, traditional plan solutions. And finally, providing planners that are capable of synthesizing them, I showed that sort of a positive news. In many cases, you can use existing planning technology to solve these problems once you actually, you know, generate the, you know, to specify the problem correctly. And then finally, in terms of learning, you know, there's a very nice connection there in terms of learning the domain model over time, learning the preferences over time. I told you some of the work we did in learning preferences, both as grammar and as feature weights, okay? And I'll leave you with this last thing that, that if you thought that planning essentially starts with a model and then you just need to optimize, you know, with respect to that model, the problem is the model is never complete. And so, in fact, planning is no longer just a pure inference over a completely specified model. It has to deal with incomplete models, which changes the solution concept, and which also brings in learning into the picture. Okay. So that's all. Thanks for your attention.
Mm-hmm. That's where we will go into the world, real world, and
Yeah, but. Yeah.
So are you working on this whole?
Yeah, so first of all, yes, I mean, that's two points. First of all, I also want to mention that there are certain planning problems, you know, that actually have been talked about in this workshop and, you know, also in other, you know, ONR autonomy workshops, where people don't expect much of a model at all. They assume that everything is learned. Now, that's possibly okay for certain kinds of problems, for things like mission planning, etc. There is like a established doctrine, and saying that I just learn everything from scratch probably may not work. So you assume that, you know, you are assuming that there is a domain model which might be incomplete, which is actually different from assuming that there is no model, you just have to learn from scratch anyway and then use it. The second issue is, in some sense, if you're coming from the side of there is a domain model which is incomplete, then you do have to consider handling the incompleteness as well as obviously during the execution, replanning. And we have worked on those, you know, individual pieces clearly. One thing that I didn't get a chance to talk about in replanning is when there is a human in the loop, it turns out that it's very important for the agent to keep track of the commitments it has made to the user. And so that when you replan, you have to be sensitive to the commitment. So, you know, the classic example is when I first came here, right, I can make any, you know, travel plan. But, you know, based on my travel plan, if I told somebody in the Bolter Hall that I'm going to drop by at right after my talk, okay, then I'm stuck with it now. Even though it's late in the evening, I still have to go there because I made a commitment to them. That wasn't part of the original problem. But it becomes part of it because the moment you publicize your plan, you will wind up making commitments with other agents. And if you have a robot and a human, there's at least one more agent other than the robot, right? And so the replanning aspect is, we look at it, at this point we are looking at each of them individually, but clearly, you know, you have to deal with all of them together. Yes. Yes. Okay, so for that, basically, the grammars of the actions. So actually, the work that the specific example, the algorithm we used there was, we would come up with, the tricky part there essentially is deciding the non-terminals first, and then we use a heuristic approach to sort of. When certain actions are occurring together more often, then we make a non-terminal for them. Now, after the first phase, you have like a big hierarchy, and then in the EM phase, we essentially remove the parts of the hierarchy that are not supported by the number of examples you have seen. Exactly. That's what we wind up doing. So, because it's like, it winds up being, the tricky part about grammar learning in this case is like the structure learning. You also have to have the structure. So the work that we did there was, we essentially make the structure heuristically and then pare it down by looking at the problem examples. But I should mention the following thing though, that, I mean, it's late in the evening and, you know, you may or may not have caught it, but one tricky issue is that learning from large number, the world is right now full of data-rich learning. I mean, your example, your work is, you know, classic example, you know, 3.5 million articles, right? Very few humans will show me 300 plans to learn their preferences, okay? Although I have done this, I also am completely aware of the fact that you need to, learning from demonstrations requires the kind of thing that Tom was talking about, because we were actually part of this, you know, DARPA project where example poor structure-rich learning is sort of what is needed in this case, because, you know, if a human is not interested in telling you what they really want, they're not likely to be interested in showing you 10,000 plans of what they do, okay? And so I think the kind of learning that is needed here really is much more, you know, learning from demonstrations with fewer examples. The part that I've shown sort of still assumes large number of example executions are available.
Sometimes it happens that even though I'm not quite sure about my preferences, that I know what the system concept
So basically that's like partial preferences. I mean, I showed one piece of the partial preference model. In fact, one interesting aspect is there was some work that I had done long back on this notion of partially hierarchicalized domains. So the idea is, think of the following thing, right? When I speak, some of you guys are thinking he's speaking grammatically wrong English, possibly. You know, I'm from India and I actually speak the Indian English, which is much more grammatical actually. But anyway, I should mention this. When I was in India the last time around, I read an advertisement where China was asking for Indians to come and teach English to Chinese. If that happens, then the Midwest English is going to be a minority, because if Chinese and Indians speak in my English, then all of you are minority. But but the more interesting point is, suppose there is a partial grammar of the language, okay, and then you follow that grammar, but there's other part for which the grammar has not been established. That's sort of, you know, that's called a partially hierarchicalized domain. So, you know, you would then check whether or not the parts for which the grammar is existing, whether it's parsable, and then there are still parts of the plan that may not be parsable at all. Parts of the sentence that are not parsable, that's because there are no rules about that. So, having extra information should always help. But as to the form of the information does matter in terms of, you know, the exact algorithms you would use to take the preferences into account. So that the closest one I know is partial preferences in hierarchical planning, for example.
Okay. So from the viewpoint of both plan and particularly replan, when an activity is underway, could you spend a moment on the role of contradictory information, how you would really handle it?
So oh, go ahead.
Sense the world and have multiple answers which may not necessarily agree with each other. Yet the planner, we'd like to plan, and the execution would be robust.
So you're talking about
like your model of the world could be.
So the inconsistent, actually.
Inconsistent, contradictory, I mean,
yeah, so actually, it's a good point. Basically, I'm assuming that my model is incomplete but not incorrect. Okay, but actually it's possible.
Could be both.
Yeah, I agree.
We could have contradictory data informing the model, but nonetheless, we can't sit there and be parallelized.
I agree. I think, you know, I have, you know, preliminary ideas on that, but I have basically, you know, got myself out of that problem.
It's a workshop, so.
The tricky issue then becomes, when there is an inconsistency, which alternative is sort of more likely, you know, that can help you. For example, so if you, for example, saw somebody who may have looked like Osama bin Laden or somebody just wearing a turban, okay, which one is more likely is going to matter in terms of what plan, I mean, how you're going to use this in the plan. Okay. Now, it's also connected to the reward, you know, in terms of you're getting an observation which is noisy. Okay. If this is the case, and you will get a plan, if this is the case, you'll get a different plan. Now, the question you have to ask yourself is, what's the risk you are taking by using this plan in the other domain? And that's the kind, I think, it's, in fact, that was discussed this morning at one point of time, I think. So the issue is, what's the downside? And if the downside is very high, then you will wind up having to...
So another form of this might be, if I think of the plan as some trajectory through some base space, right, I can think of robust plans which are, you know, in a sense, which show small variation with regard to these kinds of contradictions. So I don't do anything that really hurts me.
Mm-hmm.
Versus plans in which I make it all or nothing. It's either bin Laden or it's not bin Laden.
Yeah, I think so. Actually, in fact, even as I'm talking to you, I'm thinking that there is this other way in which you can handle this kind of noisy information about the world, where, you know, there are two. I mean, the observation is, I mean, you're thinking that the model either will have this or this aspect, and you're not quite sure which one it is. Then you can actually think of that as essentially a stochastic model, and then. The interesting thing is that the sampling-based techniques can still be used. The interesting question, of course, is you have to consider the unlikely outcomes. I mean, the samples have to somehow catch the unlikely outcome, which has a very low, very high downside for you.
Okay.
I mean, this is something that we had to deal with in, you know, in the FF, in the stochastic learning work that I mentioned earlier, where the sampling-based approaches basically miss this low likelihood domain model, which has an extremely high negative potential. Yeah, no, so then you would have to actually bias the sampling such that you'll get, you know, that. Yes, sir. No.
And that's basically model inadequacy, right? We're missing some critical thing in our model.
But
we don't really have very many good tools.
But I think, I mean, I think you are the guy who was saying this morning that when I'm driving on the road, I may not actually be completely sure of the door numbers that I have passed by. The reason that answer, I don't know, somebody mentioned this morning. Yeah. Now, the interesting question is, again, I could have, you know, contradictory information. The bigger issue is, what's it going to matter? How is it going to matter? It's not, you know, instead of just looking in terms of Occam's razor, you actually have to look in terms of what's the downside. You know, I mean, if you miss some really big, you know, this one thing can get you a minus infinity. You know, yeah. So that matters. I think that's a much more useful thing from the planning perspective for me, because I assume that planning requires, you know, it's a sort of, you know, I'm trying to optimize some sort of a utility, and so if this with this little change I'm going to lose all my money, then I better look at it.
I have a question about the robustness notion. So it sounded like, I mean, what I was expecting you to say is you're going to come up with a plan that's conforming to all of the, in other words,
but yeah, I would love to. I would love it. That would be 100% robust plan, but those things don't exist in the world, right? Because what happens oftentimes is, even for this as simple a model as I had, where there are possible preconditions effects, you know, there is no plan that will work in both, you know, domain model 1 and domain model 2, in which case what do you do? Then, and you can say, well, if you tell me it's domain model 1, I'll do this plan, but that kind of misses the point, because you will never know, you know, until the first plan fails. And if the first plan fails and you're in a non-ergodic world, you're dead. You don't get the second chance, you know. So in some sense, the best you can expect is the, you know, probabilistic robustness, which is the only thing we, you know, can do, really. Confirmant, normal.
I was thinking it's a quite a much more difficult problem to maximize the number of perturbations, I can't
rather than just looking at all of them,
yeah,
you mean.
But you're telling me it would be very easy to come up with the one, the empty set.
Exactly, that's the thing. I mean, in many of these cases, not doing anything is such a enticing an alternative. As I said, you know, if the model is incomplete, I'll wait until it becomes complete. And then that'll take a couple of centuries, and then then I'll do plan. But unfortunately, you know, my funding depends on, my life depends on actually using the incomplete model I have, and, you know, that's the interesting point. By the way, funding is not just my life, but, you know, it's not a bad thing, but.
We have a couple housekeeping kind of announcements. You know, so we're going to lose this room at 6:30. No, I mean, literally, we lose it at 6:30. And again, the IFAM staff will have to clean up after us, so it would be greatly appreciated if we take care of busing and policing the room ourselves. And the second is, tomorrow the schedule is as advertised, but it's different than the first few days. I know I form a habit like in 2 seconds. We're going to actually start tomorrow at 8:30. We will be in the other building, so, you know, back where we have been. So we'll start again. We're critical information. We're starting at 8:30 tomorrow. Back where we have been. Clean up this room. We have to be out of here by 6:30.
So we can stay till 7.
Oh, we can stay till 7. Okay. All right. So we have a little bit of time if there's energy in the room
to eat.
And if not, you know, there's snacks and we can get snacks.
I don't know. So I should have added that too to the beginning of my probabilistic topic models.
This idea of formulating a risk that includes the cost of...
Yeah, but I mean, that's planning to me. I mean, you do have to deal with this, right? I mean, I don't know whether... I did not fight the religious wars of Bayesian versus non-Bayesian, so, you know, it was fine. Okay.
Determining the next action, but then it still sounded more like I'm building a complete plan that gets me to a goal with 100.
Well, so that's the interesting question of online versus offline planning. You know, in the case of classical planning, you just do full plan. There's no difference really, because the world is under your whim and wish. So yes, so you do actually do combination of interleaving of the execution and planning, yes. In fact, the stochastic planning one is completely online, you know, so you decide the best action and see what the world does and then do the next action. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, no, because